And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells.
And from the studios at KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, interesting, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm John Wells, of course, here with Lynn Ware Peak, our first guest, Brett Velikovich, who has written Drone Warrior, an Elite Soldier's Inside Account of the Hunt for America's Most Dangerous Enemies. Unknown to most people, the U.S. Army has a small elite group of soldiers who hunt and kill terrorists with drones. Brett Velikovich was one of those people. Drone Warrior is an inside account of America's covert drone war. A former intelligence member of Delta Force, he's a Delta intelligence analyst. Velikovich was one of the few people in the military at the time who was charged with identifying terrorist targets and issuing death orders.
And good morning. Our second guest is Peter Brannan, who has written a new book called The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. In The Ends of the World, Brannan, an award-winning science journalist, dives into deep time, exploring Earth's past dead ends, and in the process, offers us a glimpse of our possible future.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Earl Foote here, CEO and Chief Technology Consultant with Nexus IT, still supporting the station and staff of KPCW. Technology can be slow, old, or frustrating. Nexus IT provides service, sales, and maintenance for your personal and business computer needs. 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Our first guest, Brett Velikovich, has written Drone Warrior, an Elite Soldier's Inside Account of the Hunt for America's Most Dangerous Enemies. Drone Warrior is an action-packed look at the on-ground reality of the U.S. drone program from the perspective of the special operators and intelligence personnel operating from the shadows. As a former intelligence member within the elite Delta Force, Velikovich was one of roughly a dozen people in the entire military at the time that he was deployed with the authority to select targets and issue death orders. His Delta Force team successfully killed or captured 14 of America's 20 most wanted terrorists across Iraq within only 3 months. Brett, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me. I was a part of a special operations task force at the time where my job was to do intelligence analysis and really go after some of America's enemies.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people think that in military campaigns, a drone is put up in the air, targets are given, a general is consulted, the general gives a kill or a no-kill decision, and that's really far from reality. Maybe you can take a minute and tell us, what is a box, who's in the box, what your role is in that box, what other collaborations with intelligence organizations outside of the box, and talk about the operators that you work with as you put these different campaigns together.
Sure. So I think, you know, when you look at the title of Drone Warrior, you might assume that I was the drone pilot or I was the guy behind the pulling the trigger, you know, so which isn't the case. You know, I was also not the, you know, Navy SEAL Green Beret guy, you know, kicking down the door, running through the hail of gunfire. I mean, those guys are superhuman. I mean, they're just incredible. If they weren't doing this work, they'd probably be, you know, professional athletes or something. But my role was really in the middle of all that. My job was to do the intelligence analysis and to analyze data and use intelligence to drive our decision-making processes. And so I was located out in the field close to the fight, and we would have the drone pilots flying missions for us that allowed us to basically use these drone videos, the live drone feeds, piped into this box, this operations center that, you know, I was surrounded by some of the best minds of the business of war in and from different organizations that are brought together to basically hunt down terrorists. And my job there was, again, to analyze the data and utilize drone technology in a way to confirm or deny information or to help guys, U.S. infantry guys, actually go in and capture these targets. And what's going to surprise a lot of people when they read this book is just how much 99% of the time a drone is used really just for surveillance and to enable guys to capture terrorists, because terrorists are worth more to us alive. And I think a lot of people think, you know, you're just striking targets indiscriminately. And there's a huge decision-making process in exactly, what takes place. But again, we're really trying to just unravel these terrorist networks and to pick apart them with precision. And one of the main ways we do that is through drones.
And the takeaway for me was that a tremendous amount of time and analysis goes into putting these individual campaigns. If you're looking for an individual person, it's not the type of thing you throw the drone up in the air. The drone's really intelligent and can identify someone. I mean, it takes months sometimes to find someone. The other takeaway was that with all the controversy that I've heard in the past about collateral damage, hey, listen, it's wartime. It can happen. That is not the intent of the U.S. Army. The U.S. Army has very, very strict rules of engagement, and collateral damage is not good.
Of course, and collateral damage, while of course mistakes happen, I mean, these are the things that kept us up at night. I mean, these are the things that devastated us when there was collateral damage from these strikes. But you also got to remember, you know, the people that we're dealing with, I mean, these are not people that just stole a pack of gum from the corner store. I mean, these are some of the worst human beings on the planet. We had to watch them as they killed tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis, as they would drive car bombs into the convoys of U.S. soldiers. We were going after the worst of the worst, and of course, sometimes there is collateral damage. But you got to realize that the people behind, and that's why I want to tell the story, is because the people behind these operations, I mean, these guys, they live, to help Americans and to help protect, innocent people, and to ensure that we don't have to fight them on our soil. And so the amount of time spent behind the scenes doing that and the amount of responsibility that guys like myself felt, it was a nonstop 24/7 cycle of doing this work. You know, I would come back from these deployments 50, 60 pounds lighter. I would be white, ghostly white, because of the stress of that. We would have guys in the around me that would have beds built next to their computer screens so that they didn't have to worry about walking back to their room and missing something on the live drone video of a target that they were watching. And there's a lot of responsibility that comes with this power that we were given to go after the enemy.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Brett Velikovich. He has co-written a book called Drone Warrior, an Elite Soldier's Inside Account of the Hunt for America's Most Dangerous Enemies. And Brett, you are the former Special Operations Intelligence Analyst, but your co-writer, Christopher Stewart, is an award-winning investigative reporter at The Wall Street Journal. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner for his investigative reporting. And I think that's this combination is so crucial of the two of you writing this book. I picked it up, and I'm so sad that I didn't pick it up until last night, because it is fascinating. It's engaging. John said he couldn't put it down. It'll be my book as I take away on the weekend. What was your decision co-writing this book?
Yeah, for me it was a pretty tough decision, and I actually met Chris when I was working out in Somalia, and he kind of brought this idea to me later down the road. And for me, it's a bit about an out of body experience to kind of talk about these types of things. But for me, the most important thing was making sure that I was honoring the men and women that were around me, and also making sure that the U.S. government was comfortable with the things that I talked to. And so all my team around me knew that, how important it was to have the book vetted and go through the proper U.S. government channels so that it can be released. And what was supposed to be a 90-day process of getting things, taken out of the book by the government ended up being a 22-month process of a back and forth with them. And in the end, you know, we were able to just write a very compelling book and write something that is a different side of the war, so that people can realize that, you know, the human beings behind the drone program, they are out there to do good. And of course, you know, mistakes happen, and it's the things that keep us up at night. But I wanted to tell from the perspective of somebody that that has seen the inside of it.
Yeah. What led you to be in the drone program? What's your background? How did you get there?
Sure. So I joined the U.S. Army shortly after 9/11. I wanted to just give back, and I felt like just this sense of purpose to join up. And I joined in the best capacity that I knew how, and that was the Intelligence Corps, and being an intelligence analyst. You know, I wasn't the tough guy in school. I wasn't the guy picking fights and things like that. You know, I was more the thinker, and I felt like that was the best way I could give back. And so I joined as an intelligence analyst, and as you start, you know, right away, right out of school, I immediately was sent to Afghanistan. And so really most of my time in the military, all I knew was war. And I went to a lot of different deployments. And eventually, you know, as people start taking notice of what you're doing and the capabilities, you know, people talk about that, and we got brought in. I basically got brought into, you know, a great special operations task force that really has handpicked different you know, military personnel to be a part of. And one of the tools that we're given to do our job there is predators and reapers and drone technology that others are flying for us. And so that was kind of how I worked my way into it. And when I first started out in Afghanistan, drones were really just like not a big thing. They were just becoming something that the U.S. government started using. And I just saw this quick proliferation of the technology because of how important they were and how many, how it was helping U.S. soldiers like never before in the history of wars.
And the book is compelling. I can only imagine how much more so it could be if the redacted pieces were allowed to be presented. But of course, you can't tip your hand to the rest of the world with exactly what our capabilities are. But we've got some pretty exciting stuff out there, don't we?
We sure do. We sure do. And the absolute limit of what the U.S. government allowed me to talk about is in this book. And I think it's going to be a really interesting read to discover some of the things that that we're doing, and also for, you know, separate from that, there's a happy end to the story of us, you know, taking the technology that would be used for war and actually using it for to preserve life and to do humanitarian operations. And so I think that's what's resonating with a lot of people who are reading it, is how I didn't just stop at, you know, my military career. I've taken the knowledge that I learned and starting to apply it for other purposes.
Well, there is a happy ending for the way the technology is deployed. There's also a happy ending for you personally, because you spent some time talking about coming back to the States after a 4-month or whatever the deployment was. And a difficult readjustment is, that's quite an understatement. You had a lot of trouble with it, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, this mental toll, this burden that guys like me had over there. Not this, you know, and it's not in the way that you may think. You know, different people have different traumatic experiences. It wasn't this, oh my gosh, I've done all these terrible things, and what have I done, and that type of toll. It's more this mental burden of knowing, you know, being desensitized to things, and knowing that if your team doesn't find this particular bad guy, that he has a chance to conduct another attack, and he lives another day. And after a while, you become obsessed with these people that you're going after. I mean, even when we'd come back from these deployments, I would just be thinking about how, you know, about all the guys we missed and how are we going to get to them next time. And just in it, what it does is it kind of takes away your perspective on reality and the rest of the world and the things going on. And so when I got out of the military, trying to adapt to that and to it took some time to kind of get my emotions back in touch and, you know, really understand what was my purpose in life and what should I be doing going forward.
We'll talk a little bit. We'll return to the good stuff, right? But we want to hover a little bit over the component that had such that took such an emotional and stressful toll on you. Take us back into the box, and they started to call you at one point Casper. You talked about that because it almost became like a drug for you to watch the surveillance. Take us there.
Yeah, so look, my typical day by 4 a.m. I've probably, pounded 3 energy drinks, and I'm ready to start analyzing more information that's coming in. We've got drones on our screens in front of us that are following targets or just simply orbiting a house, I'm sitting there watching these guys when they go to sleep. I'm sitting there watching them when they wake up. I watch when they are taking their kids to school or going to a restaurant. I see the things that people, all the different things that people do when they don't believe somebody's watching them. And if you can imagine all the things people do when they don't think someone's watching, I mean, in this case, we were seeing those things. And you also, not only do you see this evil, right, but you also see this humanity aspect of it. And when you're constantly watching people and you're looking at one of the most evil human beings on the planet staring down to what he's doing, and he goes and takes his kids to school, or he's his kid gets a flat tire on his bicycle and he's helping him pump it up, pump it back, you see you almost just feel like you're there, and it is a bit more intimate than I think we've ever had before in terms of knowing who our enemy is. And you become obsessed with that, and you also become obsessed with stopping these guys from conducting attacks, and knowing that your decisions are affecting people's lives, and that's pretty heavy for somebody that, at my age was doing this work, and the people around me that were doing this work, and we don't take that responsibility lightly, and just watching people all day long and seeing both the evil and the humanity of it can do a number on some folks.
Yeah, that is so interesting. So on the one hand, you're becoming intimate with the daily goings-on of this person's life. You see compassion and empathy to a certain degree, and on the flip side, the deep evil. And I just want you to talk a little bit about where you think that evil comes from, because we are hardwired genetically, except very, very few of us, to have compassion and empathy. So How do you believe, after watching and observing these people, the flip side kind of takes over?
I think it's just this hatred for American ideals and this hatred for what we stand for, and it's something that's been developed over centuries, and that's why it's also not a problem that can be fixed immediately. There's always going to be this Bin Laden, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, terrorist group or individual that hates Americans and wants to come and hurt us. And that is something that has been cultivated over nearly centuries. And people kind of forget that how much they remember their history, and they feel like, when we come into certain countries that were these invaders there. And this hatred just manifests also from their ability to, not get their agenda across. I mean, when you look at the history of how terrorist groups are formed, it's usually when politics fails and they take up arms to do that. And so you see that, and you see how much they, certain ones of them just have this hatred for us. And it's hard not to be, to have that same feeling towards them. When you see them, killing women and children, or playing propaganda videos online where they're cutting off, people's heads, and you kind of develop this hate as well. But our job was a lot of times to be impartial. I would have been out there doing this work, if it was any of our enemies that were going after us. It didn't have to be people in the Middle East. It could have been Russia or North Korea. I was there to do a job that the U.S. government asked me to do, and not let the politics or other things get in my way. And it wasn't my job to decide what was right or what was wrong.
Again, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Brett Velikovich, who is a former Delta intelligence analyst who has written Drone Warrior, an elite soldier's inside account of the hunt for America's most dangerous enemies. One of the other takeaways that I got from the book is the extraordinary patience that you all had in going after a target. You had these, and we love acronyms on this show, POL, which is your acronym for patterns of life. And you would watch these people through their routines for months on end until they finally altered their routine and maybe went to a different location where there was a safe house, and you were able to then crack that lid open a little bit more. Talk about patience in this in this military game.
So that's really the whole idea, is for us to do this analysis and try and understand, get into the mindset of the people that we're going after, and really help others, you know, and collectively make this decision on when is the right time to strike. And you know, strike doesn't have to be a missile. It's generally guys going in there and capturing somebody. And what happens is, you know, when you finally find you kind of find that missing piece of information that allows you to find that terrorist you're looking for, and maybe you've spotted them in a vehicle, and now you know you're following a Toyota Corolla down the road, and 100% your guy's in there. Now you've got a separate choice to make. You've got a choice to make on, is now the right time to go and get them because you might not get another chance, or do we have so much information that we can now use to have him take us to other leaders that he associates himself with? Because just like you probably associate yourselves with, you know, like-minded people, it's the same thing that they do. These guys are constantly around, you know, others within these terrorist networks. And so we want to kind of unravel that network. And so there's this patience that, this tactical patience, we call it, that takes place when you know that, you know, this, you're staring at the guy that you're looking for. You know, do we wait another day until he has a chance to conduct an attack somewhere, or do we also have the opportunity to find more of the guys around him? And that's the balance, and that's the hard decisions that we have to make inside the box.
Yeah, and we only have a minute or so left. Maybe you can quickly tell the story of how you decided to, and you made a personal decision to move away from the current targets in Iraq and Afghanistan and assist it with the identification of the Nigerian girls that were kidnapped.
Yeah, so that was something that actually took place when I was out of the military. So I was doing some contract work, and I was working with a group that was heavily focused on Northern Africa, and they had been given a drone to basically help in the fight when the Nigerian girls had been kidnapped. They were there to help support the Nigerian government. And I think the Nigerians were so surprised when relatively, you know, within 48, 72 hours of us getting this drone to use, that, you know, the guys in this this task force had basically found what we all believe to be a group of the girls hiding out. And
exactly,
when that information was provided to Nigerians, they really did, they couldn't do anything about it. And that's one of the more frustrating pieces of this job, is drone technology. You know, it's great, but without somebody that can do something with the information, you know, there's really kind of, what's the point?
Exactly. Brett Velikovich, who has written Drone Warrior, an elite soldier's inside account of the hunt for America's most dangerous enemies. Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. When we return, we're going to have a conversation with Peter Brennan, who's written The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Kick off your holiday celebration with an all-American sound when Park City Institute presents Ex-Ambassadors at the 2017 St. Regis Big Stars Bright Nights Concert Series, Monday, July 3rd. The music starts at 7, gates open at 5:30. For tickets, call 655-3114. Brought to you by the Park City Institute, entertaining, educating, and illuminating since 1998, and a KPCW supporter.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's interesting, accessible, and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek, here with my co-host John Wells. We were just speaking with Brett Velikovich, who co-wrote the book along with award-winning, well, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Christopher Stewart. The book is Drone Warrior, an Elite Soldier's Inside Account of the Hunt for America's Most Dangerous Enemies. Our next guest is Peter Brannon. He's written a new book called The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Brannon takes us inside scenes of the crime, as he calls them, from the Karoo Desert in South Africa to the New York Palisades to tell the story of each extinction. Brannon examines the fossil record, which is rife with creatures like dragonflies the size of seagulls and guillotine-mouthed fish tools. He introduces us to the researchers on the front lines. We're pleased he could join us on Cool Science Radio. Peter Brannon, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Your book's pretty exciting. Let's go first to the definition of a mass extinction.
Yeah, so mass extinction is kind of one of these sort of hazily defined terms, but it's sort of when a lot of things die pretty quickly. But there have been five times in Earth's history that are complete outliers, where upwards of 75% of life on Earth has gone extinct in, you know, what geologically is kind of a lightning strike. So a few tens of thousands of years at the most, but maybe only a few thousands of years, maybe a few centuries. It's hard to tell with some of these things because, you know, it's difficult to really make out kind of fine resolution in time in the fossil record. But we know they were devastating events where sort of the world that came after was much different than the world that came before. So it's sort of like this evolutionary reset. And scientists in the past, like 30 years, I would say, there's kind of been this sort of revolution in understanding of these things where we're starting to piece together, you know, what went wrong during these, what are the worst catastrophes in the planet's history.
Right. So it must be interesting to you as you do your research on each of the mass extinctions. Why in particular there's one that we know about far more than any other? In fact, we may only know about this one mass extinction, and that's when our friends the dinosaurs went away. Can you talk about, I don't know, the juxtaposition of that mass extinction with the others?
Sure. So the extinction of the big dinosaurs, I like to make a point to say the non-bird dinosaurs, because we still have bird dinosaurs around. Those are things with feathers and wings that you might see out your window. But yeah, the most recent mass extinction is also the most famous, and this is the extinction of the big dinosaurs 66 million years ago. So that gives you some idea of how old some of these other events are, that this is the most recent one. But there was kind of a revolution in geology in 1980 when Walter Alvarez and his dad, Luis Alvarez, at UC Berkeley, discovered what is essentially a layer of asteroid dust in the fossil record in the extinction layers between sort of the age of mammals and the age of dinosaurs. And then in the early 90s, paleontologists identified this crater in Mexico that could explain it, and you know, popular culture sort of noticed this, and you saw these movies like Deep Impact and Armageddon come out. And I think in the public imagination, there's sort of this idea that, you know, mass extinctions are these things that happen when asteroids hit. But when geologists went back to the older mass extinctions before other times, life was almost wiped out. And some of these mass extinctions were even worse than the, far worse than the one that wiped out the big dinosaurs. But when geologists went looking for evidence of asteroid impacts at these extinctions over the past few decades, they haven't been able to find them. And so I thought that was an interesting story that hadn't really reached, a wider audience. And what they found instead of asteroid impacts sort of were these major climate and ocean catastrophes that, you know, might have something to tell us about our own moment in Earth history and, you know, sort of what sort of things can go wrong on a planet if you mess too much with the ocean's chemistry and the atmosphere's chemistry and things like that. But yeah, these are very ancient, very unfamiliar worlds that were kind of taken out. So I kind of walk the reader in the book through what are worlds that were unfamiliar to me when I was doing my research, and I think are unfamiliar to a lot of people. So, sort of a tour of deep time, I guess.
And it's fascinating. I mean, you know, it wasn't the asteroid. It wasn't the volcanoes. I mean, you talk about the five previous extinctions. When things go wrong, it's not just one thing that goes wrong, but it's a whole bunch of things that can go wrong and that, you know, we have a tendency to try to wrap it up into a tidy little package where we say, oh, yeah, well, all these volcanoes hit and threw all this CO2 in the air. And that's not necessarily so.
Right, yeah. And I think even in the research community, there's a tendency to sort of divide into different camps where, you know, you'll have the group that vouches for the, you know, so at the end of at the dinosaur extinction, you also see these just unbelievable volcanoes in India at the same time. So there's kind of been these two warring camps for a while, though, you know, which was the actual kill mechanism. But I think people are starting to embrace sort of a more, you know, a more complicated view of these events, where it seems like sort of, I think one person put it to me that, you know, sometimes you roll snake eyes 10 times in a row and, you know, a lot of things are going wrong. And they, to get to these really rare, really horrible catastrophes, really everything has to be going wrong at once. So I know one of the extinctions I talk about in the book, the late Devonian extinction 375 million years ago, you know, there's everything from invasive species to massive volcanoes to trees taking over the planet and really disrupting things. And it might be that all those things were happening. And, you know, once you go over a certain threshold, life can't really take it anymore. And you sort of have this global collapse of the ecosystem.
I think we all seem to feel that these extinctions happen pretty quickly. And you just mentioned the Devonian mass extinction. In your book, you say it took 20 to 25 million years to play out, and there were 10 separate extinction peaks through the fossil and various records. So you don't get a big asteroid, and that's it for the dinosaurs. Some of these things take time. Of course, that's Cretaceous, but how did Devonian take 20 to 25 million years to get to its final outcome?
Well, so the Devonian is interesting, and it's kind of unlike any of the others, where, yeah, it seems like there's this 20 to 25 million year period of stress on the planet, where you can tell that the oceans are losing their oxygen. They're not, this is where a lot of our shale that we're fracking now in the Midwest comes from. It's from these Devonian oceans that used to be there that, you know, a lot of life was dying and falling to the bottom of the ocean and not really decaying because there was no oxygen there. So it seems like there's a lot of stress going on, but even among that 25 million year period where, you know, life is is sort of like taking this beating, there are these 10 spikes. And there's one spike of extinction in the Devonian that only played out over a few tens of thousands of years, which all alone would have been considered one of the big five mass extinctions where, you know, I think something like 80% of life on Earth goes extinct and, maybe a few hundred thousand years or something like that. So it's sort of this prolonged period of stress with these spikes of big extinction pulses. So you might have this underlying stress of a ocean without much oxygen, but then say a big volcano goes off or, you know, something like that. That can really push the planet over the edge.
Yeah, so in your table of contents, you go through each chapter as sort of a look at each of these mass extinctions. And they're words that probably won't stick with most of us, like the, Devonian is about the simplest word, but the Ordovician mass extinction. But you must have nicknames for each of these mass extinctions. How can this knowledge about the mass extinctions can be anchored with the layperson? You know, the dinosaur mass extinction would be the Cretaceous one, right?
Yeah, so I try and In each chapter, because it's sort of unfamiliar and people don't know what some of these species are with really long and kind of unmemorable names, I sort of try and pin it on a couple really charismatic animals that might have gone extinct at the time. So in the Ordovician, you have these horseshoe crab-like things called trilobites, which are sort of a fixture of natural history museums you see in the ancient Earth. And the biggest trilobite of all time is this thing called Isotelus rex. So it's not quite as scary as Tyrannosaurus rex. It's kind of just this big horseshoe crab. But, you know, I try and pin it to sort of tell the story of these creatures that were around at the time. It's hard to imagine. These are definitely worlds that most people aren't familiar with. But there were some really amazing creatures. So in the Devonian, you have these giant armor-plated fish, some of which have these sort of like, as you said in the intro, guillotine, self-sharpening bony plates for teeth. And some people have estimated they had the most powerful bite in the history of fish. And they kind of just dominated the oceans. And at the very end of the Devonian, they're wiped out by this big mass extinction. So I'm trying to introduce people to some of these crazy creatures they might not have heard about and sort of tell the story of the extinction through them.
Peter, I think you also said that guillotine fish was the size of a bus.
Yeah, I mean, there's different estimates. We only have really these big head shields. We don't know what their body looked like, so the size estimates are different for them, but I think at least 20 feet is a safe estimate for how big these things were. And if you see them in natural history museums, I mean, they're just terrifying looking. They look like mean, mean guys. And what I thought was interesting about them in particular, and something I kind of tried to highlight in the book, is that, you know, this geology is all around us. So those fish are found, the fossils of those killer fish from 360 million years ago are found in falling out of riverbanks in Cleveland, Ohio, of all places. And so certainly in Utah, you guys have amazing paleontology, but this stuff is kind of available to everyone, too. If you just learn more about the rocks under your feet, you'll be amazed by the story they have to tell.
Absolutely. Wow. So a couple years ago, two or three years ago, when Elizabeth Colbert came out with her book called The Sixth Extinction, we interviewed her. And so I'm curious where your book, you know, where she leaves off, does your book take off, or what wasn't included in her book that you include in yours?
Yeah, so I love her book, The Sixth Extinction, and her article in The New Yorker, and I think it was 2007 or 2008. Was definitely in my mind when I wrote the book, but I think her book is a great exploration of sort of what's going wrong on the planet today, and what humans have done in our recent past, and sort of what we can expect in the next few centuries. But my book is really a book about geology and paleontology, and when you go to these conferences and geologists and paleontologists are, you know, every year they're going out into the field and they're coming back and presenting these cool new, this cool new data about what they found and what it can teach us about these really catastrophic events. And one thing I highlight in my book that I thought was kind of news or hadn't really been talked about in, you know, a big, you know, popular science book, or at least hadn't reached a very wide audience, was this idea that some of these mass extinctions are caused by volcanoes that would have been capable of injecting incredible amounts of CO2 into the air, and you actually see warming and ocean acidification, which is what happens when too much CO2 reacts with seawater. It makes it very difficult for animals to live, and the oceans start losing their oxygen. And these are all things that we're starting to see, you know, at the very beginnings of today, and I think there's sort of a lesson to be learned from Earth history and from studying rocks that, you know, we tend to talk about these things like climate change, they've only ever been modeled in computers, but the Earth has actually run these experiments before in the past, and we can learn a lot from, you know, going back and studying our history on this planet, and that it should give us some pause that the most extreme versions of these events of just injecting tons of carbon into the air are associated with some of the worst things that have ever happened in the history of the planet. Now, these are, as I said, extreme versions of these things, but and maybe we could never even come close to some of these catastrophes, but it should at least give us pause that you know, this experiment we're running on the planet, we sort of have some analogs to them in Earth history, and some of them are really scary.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Peter Brannan. He has written The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. I also want to define mass extinctions as, I believe you say in the book, one half of Earth's species go extinct in a million years. Is that, that is the definition, right?
Well, yeah. So the big five mass extinctions, were events where more than half of the species go extinct. But I actually, if I could have worded that again, there are actually some things, you know, people talk about minor mass extinctions. So there's a paper out a few days ago that 3 million years ago, the oceans lost, you know, 34% of their big animals when we descended into the Ice Age. That's a minor mass extinction. It's not up there with these big five mass extinctions. So
right.
I guess there are a few different flavors of mass extinctions, and I'm just talking about really the totally crazy outliers where, you know, the planet almost gets wiped out.
Okay. Peter, define eutrophication and how it's playing out today in 2017.
So eutrophication is when you have runaway algae and plankton growth in the ocean. And when you get these big blooms of algae, they eventually decay and they die and they sink in the water and they get consumed by bacteria, which uses up, in some cases, they use up all the oxygen in the water column. And so if you have fish or crabs or anything nearby, you know, if the oxygen disappears, then basically everything around it dies. And so in the Gulf of Mexico every year, fertilizer coming in from, you know, the agricultural heartland and down through the Mississippi spills out into the Gulf of Mexico, and it spurs these huge algae blooms, which die and suck up all the oxygen. So you get these big fish kills in the Gulf of Mexico. Sometimes these anoxic zones caused by this are the size of, you know, New Jersey, so the size of states. And they're seasonal. They disappear as the seasons change, but sometimes they result in these big fish kills. And it's thought in some of these mass extinctions that the same thing happened for different reasons, but that's another example of something we're doing today that sort of has analogs in these really pretty devastating events in Earth's past.
Peter, when you are doing all this research and seeing these analogs, as you say, throughout deep history, what does it do for you? I mean, you're trying to alert the masses, right, those who might be reading your book. But what does it do for you? What does it paint such a clear picture of for what we ought to be doing that we're not?
I think I'm trying to do that. I'm also just trying to kind of instill a love of geology and paleontology. I tried to write a book that I wish I had read sort of in high school. I feel like I sort of came to this stuff late, and now I'm just totally obsessed with it. So that's one thing I'm trying to do.
That's great.
But yeah, I also thought this is kind of a way into some of these issues that are, you know, kind of tough to talk about politically, and people have kind of made up their minds about it. But this is kind of another way into it, I thought, which is less, you know, everyone's interested in dinosaurs and these old creatures. And I think there's less emotion involved. And when people just hear one side of a story and they think about the issue. I thought this is kind of a cool way into thinking about our planet as a system, where, you know, it's not a story about people and smokestacks. It's these kind of these cool stories about, you know, sort of sci-fi creatures you never would have even imagined, and sort of the ways that the planet has, on its own, sort of done this, you know, run these sort of crazy experiments, as I said. So, I don't know, I just thought it was a cool way into the what is otherwise a really contentious and hard-to-talk-about issue.
Yeah. Peter, your work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Wired, The Washington Post, Slate, The Boston Globe, and so on. You're award-winning science journalist. And I always think it's so interesting. We talk to a lot of science writers on this program. And the thing I love about that is it distills some hard science for the layperson and makes it engaging and interesting, which you've done here. But it's always interesting to hear the background as well. We have lots of like astrophysicians who have become writers. Did you have that same kind of background?
No, I kind of came into this stuff through the back door. I guess I was, you know, I might have said this, but as a kid, you know, like most kids, I was obsessed with dinosaurs. And I don't know, for whatever reason, that seems to disappear with most people. I'm not sure why as they get older, but I was kind of inspired by these paleontologists who, you know, never lost that love, and I kind of rediscovered it. But yeah, so that was part of the background. The other thing was I was writing a lot about the oceans as a science reporter, and when you write about the oceans, you kind of see that humans are messing with it in a lot of different ways. And it was, I spent a week at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts 5 or 6 years ago, and all the scientists there were terrified of this thing called ocean acidification that I had never really heard of before, and that hasn't really made it out there into the broader, you know, public conversation much, but they all seem pretty terrified by it. And it's this phenomena where carbon dioxide reacts with seawater, as I said, and it makes it tough for sea life. And if you project this toward the end of the century, it starts to get really pretty, life gets pretty miserable in the ocean. Plankton, a lot of types of plankton will have trouble sticking around. Coral reefs will be in trouble. And I, this was all kind of news to me, and I was shocked by it. And then when I learned that this has happened before in Earth's past, I thought that was fascinating, too, because I hadn't heard that story. So these events are kind of the most extreme versions of them, but I kind of wanted to tell this story that was kind of shocked me and was, I hope would I'd be able to convey that same sort of, you know, alarm, I guess, that that this was happening.
Right.
So that was definitely an inspiration for it.
Okay. So, again, back to your table of contents and all of the mass extinctions. You still have about 9 or 10 chapters in the book. So let's take us into, you also write a chapter on the future. And talk a little bit about what you believe is going on or will go on in the future.
Yeah, so I look, you know, a few centuries in the future, then a few thousands of years in the future, and then really far, basically, to the end of the planet's lifespan. So I sort of take a few different perspectives on that. Certainly in the short term, it's going to get warmer, unless we really pretty dramatically change, you know, the way our civilization gets its energy. But interestingly, in the long term, we're in the middle of an ice age, the Pleistocene, basically, which has lasted for the last 2.6 million years, where we go into these deep freezes where, you know, there's a mile of ice on top of Canada and Boston and, or maybe not quite that much on Boston, but, and then we, because of the Earth, you know, the way the Earth's wobbling in space, more sunshine hits the northern hemisphere, and there's these, you know, deglaciations where it gets warmer like it is today, and then the Earth tilts back away from the sun, and we go back into a deep ice age. We've gone in and out of many, many of these in the past 2.6 million years, and so we're in one of these brief warm periods right now. And if we weren't here, it's starting to get to the point where we might expect to go back into one of these deep freezes. So in the short term, we might spike the temperature pretty high, but I think in the long term, over the next few thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, we might go back into a deep glaciation. But in the really long term, the sun is slowly getting brighter as it ages, and eventually it's just going to become really hot. So around 800 million years from now, it's probably going to be getting too hot to support life. And, you know, if us or our descendants or, you know, maybe some machines we've made have gotten off the planet, they'll be able to endure, you know, into the deep future. But the lifespan of this planet is kind of, you know, there's definitely a clock. It's kind of depressing, but I think it's fascinating talking to people with these really, really deep perspectives on the planet and our place in it. And I think it would be helpful for us as, you know, a species and a civilization to start thinking in these sort of long-term ways rather than just, you know, the next news cycle or the next election, really come to grips with our role on this planet.
Well, the topic of mass extinctions is fascinating. It is interesting. It's good conversation. It's It's something you want to learn about. And I'm curious, you know, why did the study of mass extinctions sort of hover in the fringes for a while, and it really wasn't accepted until just recently?
Yeah, so there's this legacy in geology of uniformitarianism, it's called, which is basically Charles Lyell was this 19th century geologist who kind of pushed back against the religious idea of Noah's flood, which is that, you know, the earth can just be destroyed in this biblical destruction. And he sort of advocated for, you know, things, the earth is so old and everything can kind of be explained by these very slow geological changes. And so that view kind of dominated in the field up until around 1980 when the Alvarezes, as I said, sort of presented their paper that, you know, no, the earth can change very suddenly and it can be destroyed in a moment by something like an asteroid or, you know, big volcano or something like that. And so that was kind of a disreputable idea in the field for a long time. But now the more we learn about the planet, the more we realize that it can kind of be reset very suddenly. And so that's certainly concerning, I guess.
Peter, this is your first book. Do you have plans to write another book?
Well, I think in the course of reporting this book, I knew that it was going to be a steep learning curve, but I was kind of shocked by just how much of a learning curve it was. And now I feel like I kind of have this base of knowledge about Earth history that I'd like to sort of build on. And there's so many interesting stories and epics and periods and animals in Earth history that I'm interested in. And I think there's a neat way to tell, you know, the story of the planet's climate through paleontology and things like that. So I recently wrote a story about whales and how their evolution was sort of shaped by tectonic changes and climate changes. And so I think there's some really interesting evolutionary stories about that, just about how, you know, the whole planet works as a system, and it also shapes the trajectories of these animals that we see around us today. So I don't have anything really concretely planned out, but I'd certainly like to keep writing about this topic.
Our guest, Peter Brannon, is an award-winning science journalist, and his new book is called The Ends of the World: Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions. Peter Brannon, thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
Take care. And we'll be right back after these words.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Beth, owner of Peak Art and Frame, local sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame offers local artwork as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. It's KPCW Park City. Thanks to our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. It's time now to head into National Public Radio news from Washington.